So just to begin, could you define what austerity means now and maybe what it had meant in the past to economics?
Well, what it means now is a policy of cutting government expenditure. Now, why do you want to do that? You want to do this to achieve three goals. One is to reduce wages so that people become more competitive. That's one argument. The second one is a simple one, that much government expenditure is wasted anyway, so there's no real net loss on doing this. And once you get rid of the waste and you improve competitiveness, you're actually able to grow faster and pay back more debt. So you end up with this virtuous circle. When you cut, you end up being able to grow faster, so you pay back more debt. And it's a really nice sounding idea. Unfortunately, empirically, there's pretty much no evidence that it works.
Right. And that evidence, the greatest example of that being the Great Depression, right?
The Great Depression is one example, but there's actually lots of other examples that have happened as well. During the 1980s, there was a series of papers authored by economists who were very fond of this idea, which they gave the fancy name of expansionary austerity. And they looked at countries like Ireland and Canada and so on and said, look, these guys cut and then they grew. So therefore, all that sort of argument about spending is good and cutting is bad, this is wrong. The problem is, if you actually look at these papers in depth and strip away sort of the fancy econometrics, they get the basic histories of the countries wrong. So a very simple example of this is Canada. So in the 1970s, Canada was accumulating a lot of debt and it was growing slowly. Now, why was this? Was it the debt that was causing the problem? Well, the interesting thing was, so was America at that point in time. And 80% of Canadian exports go to the United States. So what did the Canadians do? They devalued their currency. They took 40% of the value of the loonie off. Suddenly, Canadian exports are really cheap, just as the Americans are about to go through the largest post-war economic expansion since the big post-war expansion. Consequently, the Canadian economy begins to grow like the proverbial bat out of hell, and then they're able to pay back debt. So what you actually end up showing is that growth allows you to pay back debt. The cuts have nothing to do with it. The cuts are consequences, not causes.
Explain that. I don't quite understand that.
Well, the argument is that if you cut, what happens is people's expectations of the future, because they're not going to pay so much tax, are going to get better. They're going to invest more and we're going to grow more, right? That's the theory. But the practice is actually quite different. What's actually happened is small open economies like Canada and Ireland, who have much bigger trading partners, devalue their currency. Their goods get really cheap. Their major trading partner goes into an upswing and everybody makes money. And then you're sensibly paying back some debt at that point in time. Let me be quite clear on this. The argument I make is not that you should never pay back your debt. You should pay back debt, but you should pay back debt when you're generating income. If you're actually trying to pay back debt when you're not generating income, when you're shrinking, you paradoxically just end up with more debt rather than less.
Which could be summed up in some ways by the whole, you've got to spend a dollar to make a dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
How is it that that became counterintuitive with all of this austerity? How is it that government is expected to tighten the belt when things get tight, and yet business is expected to spend money to make money?
Well, that's, you know, we have this kind of bit of a schizophrenia on this one. A very simple way of thinking about this, and I often throw this out to challenge people on this, is why is it that if the world's worst author goes to the Mac store and buys a laptop and writes his novel on it and it's never published, that somehow adds to gross domestic product? But if the government buys an Apple Macintosh computer to process a grant from a guy who gets an NIH scholarship, who ends up inventing a molecule that transforms an industry 20 years from now, that's a dead weight loss and just a waste of taxpayers' money. Now, obviously, that's not the case. These things are symmetric. To a certain extent, it doesn't matter who spends the money. If you're in, this is a military town we're in just now, what would happen if we decided to massively slash the military budget? Then all the businesses that depend upon spending through the military budget, which is a government program, would end up evaporating. So we have this very selective story we like to tell ourselves about spending in the private sector good, public spending bad. But in fact, they're symmetrical and supportive of each other. So if you're in a recession and the private sector's freaked out, as it was after the financial crisis, and it's reining in spending because it is unsure about the future, if the government does the same thing at the same time, all you're going to do is end up making a bigger hole in your GDP and your economy than you would have done if you'd actually tried to compensate on the government side. The argument for compensation, not spending for the sake of it, basically is putting airbags in the car in the event of a car crash so that you can walk away and drive another day. It's really that simple.
Talk about the difference between what happened to Ireland during the crash and what happened to the United States, and why we were able to, not with great comfort, but to some extent, we were able to ride it out and Ireland was not.
Let's not do Ireland, because Ireland is basically the size of Brooklyn, New York. Compare it to the EU as a whole.
Okay.
Right? You've got two very different... In a sense, social scientists call this a natural experiment, because you've basically got two groups of nations, right, that are kind of similar. When you add them up, they've got more or less the same population, they've got the same level of wealth, and one of them does policy A, and it goes this way, and one of them does policy B, and it goes this way. Now, apart from the sequester, because of gridlock, we were unable to cut. We didn't go on a massive spending spree. The whole Obama stimulus of $800 billion, half of it didn't even leave the building because they couldn't find projects to spend it upon. But at least we did no harm, right? So forget Keynes. Think of Hippocrates. First, do no harm, right? Now, the Europeans had no such truck with this, and they decided we all need to tighten our belts all at once. This is the way to go. And what's happened is they've generated, throughout the south of Europe, 25% unemployment. 50% youth unemployment, that's people between the ages of 25 and 34. It's a big expansive definition of youth, right? And what you've got in the core, the countries that are doing well, they're completely dependent on exports, which means the Chinese and the Americans are buying their stuff. So if that ever stops, they're in trouble. They've got a hugely fragile banking system they haven't begun to clear out yet. And they're growing at 1% if they're lucky. Now, they did the cuts, and that's what they got. We didn't do the cuts, and we're basically on our way to reduce an unemployment of below 7%, and we're going to have a growth profile without the sequester coming forward of above 2.5%. So there's no debate here. We did the experiment, they tried it, and once again, it failed.
At what rate does a healthy, sustainable economy generally grow?
That's a really good question. We change our minds on this. And we change our minds on this not because of the economics, but because of the politics. So think about what's gone on over the past 35 years. We've had an incredible skewing of income and wealth, not just in the United States, but across the whole of the developed world. Even countries that were traditionally quite equal, such as Germany, have actually become much more unequal. And this creates a problem for growth going forward, because if you have large post-industrial economies, like the United States is 80% services-driven, right? Its manufacturing sector is only 11% of GDP. Now, how do you power a service sector? You do that through consumptive spending. And unless you've got real wage growth, which we haven't had for the past 30 years because most of the gains have gone up to the top 10%, then you've got a problem, because the only way people can continue to spend is what? Credit. So basically, everybody's giving credit hand over fist, right? Well, what you're doing is you're filling in the gap for the lack of real wage growth, which is caused by a huge amount of factors, not just inequality, also technology, globalization, all these things, right? But basically, it's very hard to get a very large consumptive-driven economy going if everyone's broken in debt. So we extend them credit, which simply gets them more in debt. Now, what we're doing, strangely, is we're worrying about public debt. I worry about private debt, because that's the real brake on the economy, and that's where we need the action. The United States debt is guaranteed by 11 aircraft carriers, B-2 bombers, and the global reserve asset. By the time that we look like Greece, you can rest assured that every other sovereign alternative is already in flames. There is simply no reason to worry about this stuff. And yet, we have an entire industry in Washington freaking out about the debt, and people can't hold enough dollars worldwide. And yet the real problem is the fact that normal people are up to their eyeballs in debt, and they're not growing their incomes in a way that will allow them to pay it off.
Mark Blythe, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Bye.